Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to an edition of Politics Done Right. I'm Roberto Williams, your host. Thank you for being with us. What are we going to talk about? Wealth and income disparity. You know, it's interesting that I'm over here at Star College in Conroe, Texas, and we had a wonderful group of United States citizens that sat down in a room and simply discussed politics. We discussed income inequality, foreign issues, and all these other items without fights, without shouting, without any of these things. We actually simply discussed. People listened, people disagreed, but we did it in an agreeable manner. And that is what I hope to attain with this call today as well. Eric, how are you doing today?
Hey, Brito, I'm doing good.
Good. Where are you located today?
I'm in Central Virginia right now.
Okay, well, I tell you something. I actually announced at our little group today the 535 Project and encouraged quite a few. We had probably about 40-something, 50 people here at this talk. And encourage mm-hmm. them to join. Hey, come on
awesome.
Up with us. Yeah, so I mean, as I said, this is something that we're planning on moving ahead and going forward with. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about this, Eric?
Okay, sure. I mean, the idea is in addition to advocating for things that we think that members of Congress need to do to address the issue of money in politics, we should form teams in every district, all 435 congressional districts, as well as teams for each Senate office, to work with elected officials and ask them what their plans are to address the issue of the corrupting influence of money in politics. And then through the conversations, which we will share as content on the website that we're building out to have all of these 535 pages, communities will form online so that people in different districts can keep tabs on how their representatives are voting and also how they're responding to this growing demand that our Congress address this issue of corruption. And by the time we reach the 2014 midterms, the goal is to have basically a list of representatives who are not working with the people on this issue, and we may need to recommend replacing.
Excellent. That's a good synopsis of what we're doing. Frank has started laying out quite a bit of it. I don't know if you've been in the email chain or not, but I understand also, Eric, that today we have somebody calling from the Tower Radio Station. Is that what it's called?
Yes. Well, first of all, I haven't been as engaged because I'm shooting a documentary right now, but that is excellent news that you guys are making progress with the strategic planning on it, and that's what Coffee Party is all about.
Mm-hmm.
People with great ideas have the tools and the encouragement and the infrastructure to act on them. Jeff Rousseau, I think that's how you pronounce his last name.
Right.
The Prometheus Radio Project is going to be joining us, and that is... And it's a very interesting thing because, I mean, Jeff can tell you more about it, but many years ago, maybe it's 30 years ago, the federal government, which of course administers the public airwaves for the people, said, hey, we're going to open up these FM bandwidths for local stations. But what happened was a conservative group got together and filed all of these applications on behalf of the local communities. And then they just pumped Rush Limbaugh through those stations for 30 years, and you saw the damage it's done. So another opportunity is coming up in 3 months for the people to apply for local radio stations and basically use our own, you know, public airwaves for good. But we need to organize a little bit in order to do that, to fill out the applications and to find the teams of people who are willing to get together on their spare time and create a radio station. You don't have to be, you don't have to broadcast 24 hours a day, but you should do some local content, and then you can syndicate stuff like this show.
Now, as president of Coffee Party, what are your recommendations? Are you recommending that we start to look at that project per se in different local Coffee Party districts, or what are you suggesting?
Yeah, I definitely want the Coffee Party, members to be involved in this, but it is an undertaking. It has to be. I think our internet radio audience is probably the best sort of customers for this idea, because they already understand the power of having we the people do the talking instead of just the listening. So I'm hoping that people who have all over the country, subscribe to our internet radio shows and sometimes call in and contribute to them, which is the thing we like the best. Some of those people might, because of Prometheus Radio Project, be connected with other people who maybe don't even, know we have internet radio, but they're more focused on FM bandwidth and AM, radio, and they want to, do that. And then we can sort of connect the kind of innovation that we see in internet radio with the more old-fashioned, beaming from a satellite. It's not a satellite, it's a radio tower. Right. That's still important. And we need to make sure the people are heard in all the different avenues.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Before I forget, folks, the number is 646-929-2495. Again, that number is 646-929-2495. Give us a call. If you want to talk, please push 1 so that I can know you want to talk. A whole lot of you guys are on here, but nobody's pushing to talk. Well, I just said that, and what happened? 513, push to talk. 513, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Laura, and Alberto, I hate to say it, but you're breaking up really bad, sweetie.
Oh, Laura, sorry about that, but we're calling from we are on site at a university, so we may have a little bit of a internet problem. Eric, are you hearing a whole lot of breakup right now as well?
Yeah,
well, you just did really well now, but earlier you were really bad.
Oh, okay. Well, look, I appreciate that. It's not really, really bad right now. So, Laura, how are you doing? What's the word for today?
Well, I don't know if you heard, I just went through surgery 2.5 weeks ago, so.
You did?
I'm kind of in and out of it.
Well, I hope you're not taking too much of those pain pills now.
Oh, no, because you take too much of it. Well, number one, they won't give you much anyway.
I know. I know. Well, look, Laura, you make sure to take care of yourself, and thanks for telling me how things are going. Now, 908, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hey, buddy, John from New Jersey.
Hey, John from New Jersey, talk to me.
Good. Yeah, you were breaking up a bit before. Something was happening.
Is it a bit clearer now?
It's better right now, yeah.
All right, talk to me, John.
Well, you may remember you and I and others, of course, were talking about whatever this whole thing about, the president hasn't proposed a budget, that kind of stuff. All that talk that keeps going on, But, of course, you listen to other people. And this is the correct on it. First of all, of course, he did propose plenty of budgets recently, okay? The thing that they do, if they keep filibustering his budget, there's no way that it can get passed. They keep saying, he hasn't passed the budget. You're right, he can't. You don't have the votes to pass it. So, they try and keep making him look like a fool. So then they keep saying, they say, he hasn't proposed a new one. Well, why the hell is he going to propose a new one? You're just going to filibuster it every time.
Absolutely.
I mean, like we've said, of course, the true thing is, regardless of all these proposed budgets that can be discussed, that can whatever, and they don't have full whatever, because all budgets still, regardless, even if they're discussed, even if they can be voted upon, even this and that and approved, okay, they still have to go from the House to the Senate, to the president, okay?
Now,
they still
John,
have to go
also,
that way.
Isn't it also true that actually all these budgets should really, by law, technically speaking, originate in the Congress? Is that correct?
No. Again, I mean, a Congress is the Senate and the House, okay?
Right. I meant the House.
But
yeah.
It has to, like all other bills except budgetary financial bills can originate.
Okay, I'm going to have to put you on hold right now because we have our special guest that just called in, and then I'll be one of our regular callers here live, Mr. Bruce Barnes, right here at the Lone Star College with us as well. But hold 1 second and stay with me, John. 845, is this going to be Jeff? And let me, I guess it'll help if I click you in. This is Jeff, is that correct?
That is correct.
Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Excellent. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the Prometheus Project?
Sure. So the Prometheus Radio Project is a nonprofit organization based in Philly that fights to build community radio as a tool for social justice organizing and movement building. We successfully fought a 10-year campaign to expand access to community radio stations in urban areas. And this October 15th, nonprofit organizations, labor unions, social justice groups, community organizers will have a one-time chance to apply for non-commercial FM radio licenses that are going to be going up for grabs all over the country in the largest expansion of community radio in U.S. history and the final major opportunity for groups to get access and ownership of the FM airwaves.
Now, if I recall, I saw some videos on your website, and I think I saw a station in New Orleans that actually did this. Now, how many stations do you have under the Prometheus Project that are actually live right now?
So what Prometheus does is one of the things we do is we advocate. We pressure the FCC to open up this space on the dial for non-commercial groups to have their voice on the air. So in 2000, we first pressured the FCC to create the low-power FM radio service. At that time, about 800 licenses were issued, and there were about 800 groups on the air. And most of those, however, about half of them, most of those licenses got gobbled up by conservative evangelical religious networks.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's the competition this time around. But for example, one of the groups that we helped to get on the air, we've had 12 radio barn raisings so far, which is when we actually help groups to build the station. We get the community together. We do workshops and trainings on audio production and organizing volunteers and actually help to put up the tower. That's not including hundreds of other groups that we help through the application process to get on the air. But for example, one of the groups that we helped build one of these stations is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Immokalee, Florida, which is a group of migrant farm workers fighting for human rights and fair food in the tomato fields of South Florida. So if you've ever been to McDonald's, Taco Bell, Burger King, and eaten any of the food there, you've probably had tomatoes that were grown in Immokalee. And so what the CIW has done is they've used this radio station to organize farm workers in Immokalee to fight for workers' rights, and they have been able to use the radio as an organizing tool along with, you know, just incredibly strategic campaigns to win historic labor campaigns and labor victories against the biggest food companies on the planet like Burger King, McDonald's, Whole Foods, Taco Bell, Chipotle, Trader Joe's, and more. So, you know, we hope that by expanding access to these stations now for the first time ever out of rural areas into urban areas where people can have these stations in medium and large size cities as well, that they can be a powerful organizing tool and also a tool to get really good quality local music and local news on the air, which is absent from commercial radio and commercial media generally.
That is impressive. Now, what is usually the range of those as FM stations?
Sure. So the range of these stations is up to a 10-mile radius.
A thousand? Did you say
10 miles?
Oh, 10 miles. Okay.
Yeah. No. So these are local radio stations that have been called hyper local, right? So they're really meant for if there's a denser population, you know, But what we're talking about here is that in some medium and large size cities, one of these stations, which it, you know, the range really varies depending on the location, but in cities it'll probably be more like 3 to 5 miles. But in some areas, you're talking that these stations can reach tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people.
Right, and especially in densely populated areas. But let me ask you something that's rather important. First of all, I think you mentioned that the window for applying for these licenses are closing, or it's closing.
Well, it's actually going to open in October. So
it opens in October.
The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, is going to open up a filing window that we expect will be about 1 week long in mid-October. So right now, we are preparing groups to get their paperwork ready, to get their volunteers ready, to start fundraising, to do all the work that they need to do so that on October 15th they can successfully submit applications. And again, there's going to be competition from the right. There's going to be competition, you know, especially in bigger cities. There's going to be competition. We're working to get folks ready so they can submit winning applications on October 15th. And if folks want to learn more or stay updated about this opportunity, they can go to PrometheusRadio.org and sign up for updates, and we can support you through the process.
Now, let me ask you this. If Coffee Party, like Coffee Party Austin, Coffee Party the Woodlands, they're very active. Suppose they wanted to engage in something like this. First of all, what would be the startup cost of doing something like this?
Mm-hmm. So the application itself is free. The license is free. The only upfront cost that groups have is an engineering study. So basically, you need to talk with an engineer. Say you want to reach specific neighborhoods in your city. You need to talk with an engineer and say, what frequencies are available if I want to reach listeners in this few mile radius? Where's the best place for me to put an antenna? The engineer will do that study, do the technical piece, and you've got to pay the engineer. So those engineering costs vary. They can vary from $300 to a couple thousand dollars. But in some cases, you also won't need an engineering study at all. We've built some software online that can help groups do some of that work. And in some cases, you know, if you're in like a really big city or the terrain is particularly unique, it might be even more. But on average, between $500 and a couple thousand bucks to pay an engineer so that you can submit the application, and then you've got multiple years to fundraise before you build the station. And we estimate that you can start a low power FM radio station for as little as $10,000, but in most cases you would have 2 to 4 years to fundraise that money.
And approximately what does it cost for the basic equipment for a, let's just say, a basic system, a few mics, a transmitter, and you know, a simple mixer?
Yeah, I mean that's the $10,000 figure that I stated is what we estimate for all.
Okay, I got it. That's actually Indiegogo. Have you had anybody using groups like features like Indiegogo to raise that kind of capital for these types of projects?
It's definitely something that we are encouraging people to do to fundraise, is to start Kickstarter campaigns and Indiegogo campaigns. Absolutely. You know, however groups fundraise at a grassroots level, that's the kind of fundraising that a lot of these community radio stations undergo to raise the money. You know, one of the things that we've learned from studying the field and talking with so many folks on the air is that the difference between a successful community radio station and one that fails is the amount of community engagement. So we're really, you know, if you're just someone who really loves radio, you know, and you think you're going to build a station, you should think again, because really the way to build a sustainable, strong station is to really involve the community and to connect with different organizations, to bring in diverse groups of people to work on this project together. And that way you can not only raise the money, but also build the capacity, the people power to run a powerful station that can transform the media and transform communities.
To be sure, are these pretty much just, let's say, nonprofits, or these stations are all nonprofit? Is that correct?
These are all nonprofit. That's right. You have to be a nonprofit organization, schools, schools are also eligible, schools, churches. You have to be a nonprofit, though.
And does it matter if it's 501c4, 501c3, or just any one of them?
No, that doesn't matter. You have to be a state-recognized nonprofit.
Excellent, excellent. So what other information should our listeners know about the Prometheus Projects before we move on?
Well, I'd say that, you know, if you're in an area, you know, there's a role for everybody to play. So even if you don't have your own nonprofit, you can still play a role in helping to start a community radio station in your area. Not only that, but if you know groups, if you know social justice groups, if you know immigrant communities that are struggling, if you know places where people are fighting for racial and economic justice, you know, we need help doing outreach. So we're doing outreach until the end of June, and we've got that much time to get the word out all over the country that this opportunity exists. So we want everybody to help spread the word on Facebook, Twitter, get on our webinars. We've got a big webinar coming up this Wednesday night. You can learn about it by going to prometheusradio.org/March 27th. Learn more, join this movement, and together we can transform the media and build multimedia media centers, community centers across the country that can be hubs for community organizing and spreading the word and really building social movements, because the media is just such a powerful tool. And right now we're letting major corporations and the elite control this tool. If it was in the hands of the people, we could win a lot more victories. So please, I encourage everyone to go to prometheusradio.org and learn more and participate. Help us build community radio stations all over the country.
Hey, absolutely. Jeff, if you get a chance, why don't you just write me a short blog, send it to me by email. I'll be more than happy to blog it at several places where we blog and to get your message out. I think this is pretty darn important. I think that with the amount of companies that are now controlling our media being so small, the more we can actually localize a lot of our message. In fact, if you take a look at what the right wing has done over the years, they've actually done this in a reverse concept. And if you take a look at what you said in the beginning, that's exactly what they've done. You got 800 licenses, and who gobbled them up?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the state of the media today, we've got about 5 companies that control the vast majority of everything that people in this country see and hear. And when we look at radio specifically, there's one company, Clear Channel, that owns over 850 radio stations across the country. Of course, Clear Channel is owned by Bain Capital, which is Mitt Romney's company. And, of course, radio specifically has been used strategically by the conservative right to prop up voices like Rush Limbaugh and others that help build popular support for repressive policies that we see sweeping the country. So it's very important that us as progressive leaders and social justice movement organizers recognize the strategic importance of controlling our own media and controlling the message. And the chance to start community radio stations is a major opportunity for us in that regard, and we can't let this window slip by. It's a one-time-only chance this October. So please tune to prometheusradio.org and learn more and get involved.
Hey, Jeff, thank you very much. That was an excellent segue with the justice movement that we're all working on to go into what we've been doing here at Lone Star College here in Conroe. I have here Mr. Bruce Barnes, who was a part of our little symposium here. What do you think about it, Bruce? What do you think about what we did here today?
I thought it was very good.
Let me make sure.
Am I hearing? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. We had a very nice meeting here today, and we talked about a lot of different subjects and current events, and everybody got involved, and I think we had a very good meeting.
Well, excellent. We also have Mary in the room. When Mary is done with her sandwich, I'm going to ask her to come on. This is the first time that we're actually coming live, thanks to Kurt here, who allowed us to come into his domain. Kurt, let me tell you guys a little bit about Kurt. Kurt is this great guy. Kurt called me and said, Egberto, why don't you come and give us a little talk? He bought my book, and he said, come on and give our group a talk. And I said, no problem at all. And I had never seen him before, but we kind of spoke a whole lot over the telephone. And he said, look, I have a group here that I meet. How long have you been doing this now, Kurt?
We've been doing it since January of 2000.
You've been doing it 8 years. Folks, 15 years, he's had a group here meeting people of all stripes. Kurt, not everybody here is liberal, are they?
No. We have a range. We're probably two-thirds liberal and another third conservative, and we have extremes in both directions.
Yeah,
we have conversations.
And that I can attest to, because today's topic that was discussed was wealth and income inequality. And while a good percentage of the group was quite amiable to the discussion as far as where we were leading, you had quite a few people that were opposing to our views on how capital should be handled. What you thought about that? I think, Kurt, you were a little bit, when I said a few things about capital, it kind of irked you a bit as well.
Well, I wouldn't have said it the same way. That's true. But we've never made it, I tell people it's not important whether they agree with me or not. If they have an opinion, I really hope it's theirs.
And, and you know, that is one of the good things the way the Coffee Party actually works. You know, the only way you actually can make progress and move forward is if everybody thinks they have, number one, skin in the game, and number two, that they're being listened to, and number three, that they're all looking for an ultimate goal, an ultimate place to go. Hey, folks, I see a whole lot of you on the line here. Nobody pushing one to say you want to talk. Telephone number six. I'm going blind. The number is 646-929-2495. Again, the number is 646-929-2495. Now, earlier you had made a statement, Kurt, that said, I was listening to your talk. And by the way, folks, Kurt is like a one-man news machine. He comes here and he gets his PowerPoint. That is, how long did it take you to prepare that PowerPoint?
That only took about 10, 12 hours.
Only 10, 12 hours. That's funny.
Well, when I'm doing the whole thing, it's 20 hours.
Yeah. Okay, John, I haven't forgotten about you. I want to get Kurt in here because what Kurt is doing here in Conroe, I think, is impressive. Kurt brings a whole lot of people together to talk, and we really have some really had a good talk here. I'm going to have to try to talk to him about incorporating this whole group into Coffee Party USA. What do you say about that, Kurt? Start your own Coffee Party group.
We already have the leader of your local group. I didn't realize that.
Virginia and Pat, yes.
Virginia and Pat, yes.
Yeah.
I've known about the Coffee Party, and there are other people that have been going to your meetings here too. So, and that's fine. Every idea that I have, I hope it leaves the room and either clones itself or evolves.
Actually, it did pretty good. You guys should see how this guy runs this room with all the news stories. I mean, every actual story of interest this week was covered, from Israel right back. Even had some of the income stuff in there. You know, he had my attention for the entire time, so much so that I forgot what I was going to talk about for a while. But but that's all right. But anyway, John, I'm going to bring you back in. I think I had cut you off earlier. What did you want to say, brother?
Well, again, let's even go into an example. Like, okay, Simpson and Bowles, right? They made a
yes,
proposal.
Sir.
Okay. Now, of course, the normal route for which a bill to, in order to be like truly accepted and that kind of thing. So guys like Simpson and Bowles can, Egberto can go propose a budget, right? In essence. But of course it's got to go through committee first, right? So they got to prove if it's going to go to the floor, you know what I mean? Cause otherwise they ain't going to even give it any consideration kind of stuff. So like Simpson and Bowles was something, of course, was, you know, discussed upon. They're like, okay, it went through, you know, the committee, and then they accepted it. And of course, it can get, you know, looked upon or even voted directly upon. You know, like the House can just approve of it, all right? So the House can approve of it, then the Senate can approve of it. Then it's up to the President to make it, you know, official law. But like all budgets, that's the way, the only way it can be. But again, the President can, whatever, come to the House. Yeah, they'll say, okay, yeah, the committee, yeah, let's approve so it goes to the floor, you know, and then they'll pick it apart. Then this way they can, you know, wait to have him bring in his budget so they can pick it the heck apart, And that's all they've been doing. And they've been filibustering it regardless so that they know he don't have the votes for it. So, you know, this whole thing, he hasn't passed enough, you know, he hasn't passed the budget. You're not going to let him pass a budget.
Well, you're right on that. Anyway, my buddy John, stick around and listen to what we're going to be talking subject at hand. You want to say something?
I would like to talk about the how it goes by the Constitution that must be started in the House. But the president is the executive, and he spends the money. And it's always good to know where that money is going and how it is being spent. So that's why he presents his budget, or really a report on where the money is going. The House and the Senate are equal in that they actually do a budget that is, how would you say it? Not precise, but
okay, yeah, an estimation, yeah.
An estimation of, and then the executive branch breaks it down and makes it go more specific. So by the Constitution allowing the House to actually start any financial bill, it is their responsibility to pass a budget, and they've sent it to the Senate. If the Senate does not agree, they send it back, and therefore they must compromise with what the budget is. So it's the House's responsibility to make the budget passable through the Senate and also through the president, since he can veto it or not. So this thing about the Senate not being passing a budget or anything is just hocus.
Excellent. All right, going to the subject that supposedly we are talking about today, and I don't know, are you still there with us, John?
Yeah, I'm trying to. He sort of broke up, but I don't really understand exactly what he perfectly said. But what he said is I know is incorrect. He said something, or maybe he can clarify again, that the president has the responsibility of what was that?
Go ahead, Bruce. The president is the executor.
The president is the executor and actually spends the money. So all the departments report back to him as to what they have spent and what they are budgeting for the following year.
That's absolutely untrue. Every bill, every financial bill and every whatever on what the government spends is signed, is approved, or then signed, approved in essence. You know, when the president signs it, he approves it. So all three branches are the ones spending that. Well, those three particulars: the House, the Senate, and the President. They approve everything. They approve everything that's spent every year. So to say that the President is responsible for spending and all the debts over the years is totally incorrect. Same thing with Reagan. Reagan, who actually, on a percentage wise, during his terms, spent more than any other.
Okay, John, you're breaking up a bit. We're here at Lone Star College. This is called Lone Star College Montgomery, not Conroe. It's Lone Star College. Is it Montgomery or just Montgomery County? Okay, it's Lone Star College Montgomery. Folks, the telephone number is 646-929-2495. Again, that is 646-929-2495. I'm also here with Mary. Mary is one of the local activists that wherever I go, whatever activism that I am doing, somehow Mary is there. We were out there at Occupy Houston. Mary was there. We were there at Occupy. We're in Kingwood. I don't know if you're in Kingwood, but one of your proteges were there in Kingwood. We went and talked about single-payer health care. Mary was there. We went to Austin. Mary was there. How you doing, Mary?
I'm doing just fine. I really enjoyed your presentation this morning. And as you said, we had a very active conversation, and we had a little active discussion with a woman in an orange top, and I hope her top doesn't turn burnt orange. But anyway, and as far as the budget is concerned, and you were mentioning Simpson Bowles, there's one thing I want to say about that. I would not trust a budget that purports to make cuts to Social Security and the rest of it that has been devised by somebody who made the most derogatory and insulting comments about Social Security recipients. And I'm referring to Alan Simpson. But he was allowed to continue as co-chair of that committee, even though there was a lot of pushback about it. President Obama saw fit to not take him off the committee. But anyway, that was that. And there's something else I want to talk about.
Well, actually, we that's all right. We actually did. We talked a whole lot about things that I would really like to square up. I had mentioned, and I don't have the...
I do remember one thing.
Yeah, go ahead.
In Texas right now, we're having this big discussion on Medicaid expansion. Governor Perry has come out and said that he does not want to accept the federal payments for Medicare expansion. He's one of the few governors. He's not one of the governors that changed their mind back and said, yes, they would accept the payments. We have a state senator right here in the Woodlands named Tommy Williams. And so it's really near to where I live, and I figured, well, I'd stop on over there and talk to the people in his office. I talked to two very nice ladies that work in his office, and a bunch of us had received a memo that came around about, you know, his objections to it. There were two big points in that. One was that people ought to have skin in the game. So I talked to them about that, and I said, what is this with this skin in the game? You know, he said people should go to, say, health clinics and not emergency rooms if they need a sort of small routine care, and he thought that was a good idea. But yet if they do go to these clinics, he thinks they need to have skin in the game, meaning pay something. And I said, well, I kind of question that. Like, what was that even supposed to accomplish? And then so the one woman said, oh, but there would be very small payments, like a couple of bucks. And I said, well, there's absolutely no sense in doing that because the administrative costs
is more than $2.
Collecting and keeping track of those payments would be a loss to the state, not any kind of a gain. And what do you think this is supposed to change? I mean, people really don't have any choice, pretty much, especially Medicaid people, over where they would go to get their health care. So I just really don't understand what kind of a lesson people would learn from that. The other thing that was on that memo said that Tommy Williams apparently feels that if we were to accept Medicaid expansion, our costs would go up greatly. And I said to the women, in Cindy and Karen, in the office, can you explain that to me? That just makes no logical sense. Because if a state accepts the Medicaid expansion, they're going to get 100% paid by
for the first 3 years.
Then
it's 90 per 9 to 10.
Yeah, and the only thing they could come up with to tell me that was any kind of a reason for that was that, oh, well, we have so many people signing on to that system. And at that point, I was just totally...
That, you know, Mary, I'm coming to you next, Laura. I see that you have your hands up. The thing that drives me whenever... Folks, first of all, I want to give context to what Mary had to say. What's important with what Mary had to say relative to what we are doing here at Coffee Party is Mary did exactly what we have to start doing, and that is engaging the politicians, having the politicians realize that we are watching what they're doing, and not only are we watching what they're doing, but there would be consequences if they don't act appropriately. But there are more of us that need to be doing that. Now, secondly, with respect to when people come out and say things like, well, if we somehow extend privileges to these people to have health care, more are going to show up. Actually, that's what we want.
Exactly.
We want more people to show up so that their conditions would be caught at earlier times and so that they won't overwhelm the emergency rooms. That's what we want. But here's the real big thing. And folks, before I forget, don't forget to call 646-929-2495. A lot of this is ideological. It will be an ideological win for the ACA to be successful. First of all, the ACA is not going to be successful, Mary, all right? We know that. You and I know that very well. The ACA will migrate into what? Single payer.
It has to eventually.
Okay, that's the only real solution.
Exactly. Not by healthcare reform.
But you and I think you and I discussed this at Coffee Party before, where I said this was a necessary first step, because just like I was talking to this great audience today, where I said it's a matter of us re-indoctrinating ourselves, because we have been so taught that certain procedures are some form of socialism, or, you know, we have to reprogram ourselves into thinking in some manner. Before I go any further, let me get Laura on. Laura, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, there's 2 points I want to make. And first, don't try not to cut me off, okay? One point is the skin in the game point. Okay, and I have butted heads with more than one person working in a medical office about this. Medical people have a tendency to be very arrogant. The best of them don't, okay? And here it is, they think that if people are getting free medical care, they will abuse it by coming in when nothing's really wrong with them. But I will tell you that if they can't figure out what is wrong with you, their attitude will be, there is nothing wrong with you. But I know people who have died going to several doctors who said, oh, I can't find nothing wrong with you, so therefore there is nothing wrong with you. But they died from it.
Well, that is a pretty standard thing, you know. That is pretty standard. Let me ask you something, guys. We're using an external speaker here. Is there any feedback that's showing up in the background? I guess not. Yeah, this I think is a directional mic. Okay.
Doctors I know will admit that there could possibly be something wrong, but that they may not, you know, be
absolutely
familiar with or may not know about.
You're absolutely correct, Laura. You said you also wanted to make a second point and to make sure absolutely not. But you know, I wouldn't do that to you.
Another thing that people don't understand is states do have, at this time, okay, I don't know much about Obamacare, but at this time, states do have rights to kind of play around with the rules for these programs like Medicaid. In the state of Ohio, if the only way you can get Medicaid is if you're a minor child, over 65 and over, or legally declared disabled, and then also meet the financial criteria. And here's the really weird thing. Okay, if you're over the financial criteria of $600 a month, they can put you on what is known as a spend down, which means, let's say you make $700 a month. Well, that $100 a month over, you pay that out to your medical care. Let's say you have $150 a month in pharmacy bills every month. So you pay the first $100, and then after that, they start paying that in for your medical care after you pay the first $100. But here's the really funny thing. If you will also be collecting food stamps on that kind of income. And food stamps will take into consideration that $100 of your income is going to your medical care, and so they will kick in some extra food stamps. Isn't that weird?
It's actually pretty weird. We do everything that is necessary to, I don't want to quite say it in an unfriendly manner, but we do everything that is necessary to screw the middle class, because, I mean, there are a lot of...
it's convoluted.
Exactly. It is absolutely convoluted. But you know what? Our third protege is here and hasn't said a word yet. Charlie, tell me what you think about what we've gone through today with our income inequality talks.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't able to come to some of it because I was going out and getting coffee. But
you mean you missed our income inequality talk? But you know what? Yes,
this is a coffee party event. We need coffee, okay? I'm very familiar with the topic, so if you throw up some things.
Well,
I will say that I've been participating in a lot of different events, including things like Mary did a great presentation at our church on it.
Right.
But one of the points that came up was, why are we... why are we penalizing the people that earn money, and why? What good will it do to? One of the questions that I found fascinating was, what good will it do to
let's say we took 10,000 people who were CEO class and reduced their salaries, all of them, at once, what good would it do? And the answer was probably not that much. It would make a very tiny dent in the actual situation. So the answer that I got, and this is in the group that Mary was with too, is, okay, let's not worry too much about cutting the top. Let's work about moving the bottom.
Right.
Specifically, the minimum wage as an example. So if you want to change the game, why only concentrate on the high end? Let's concentrate on the low. And I think we'll get a lot more support by doing a cogent explanation of how we raise the low and why. And that's where I think we ought to concentrate our efforts.
I mean, I think that's an excellent point. The problem about it is, as you see with our orange friend, our orange sweater friend, she was not very friendly to these types of what she would seem to believe are less capitalistic type actions. I say that again.
You may have been goring. It all depends on whose ox is getting gored.
Right, but so I think.
Or what the perception is.
Yeah, could you come a little closer to the mic just to make sure that we get your great voice in? But you know, I'm coming to you, John. I saw that you just cycled. You know. That is true as far as who are your – what's the word you use? Gordon?
Gord.
Okay. Got it. Okay, I got you. You know, but sometimes that is necessary, you know. I mean, I think it's all in how you do it, because I don't think she wanted to really jump out of the chair and hit me or anything like that.
No, she can – we go back and forth. That's fine. She's
yeah.
Pretty
And I thought she was very respectful. Of course, her facial features, when I said certain things about inequality, she really I could see her squirming, and that's why I always went back and tried to get her to talk and get her opinion out so that it doesn't look like we're disregarding her. It looks like John wants to say something again, so let me get John back in. John, what do you need to say, my brother?
Yeah, your last friend there, he was in and out as far as you hearing him again. And then, again, it's sort of breaking up back and forth again. Just something still whatever with the audio. But let me go into interesting Bill Maher, all right, on his show recently. I don't know if you saw it. And they starting to talk to all these conservatives, you know. All right, you know.
Wait, let me back up. Is it this week's show or last week's show?
This one.
Oh, this was a great show this week. Go ahead.
Yeah, he says, well, I thought this was the most fantastic thing about it. He says, okay, well, you know, as conservatives, we gotta cut the budget. The government's spending too much. Okay, well, ask these people, what do you want to cut back on? Military? No. What do you want to cut back on? They even did people in New Jersey. Do you want to cut back on the Sandy relief? No. What do you want to cut back on Medicare? No. Do you want to cut back on Social Security? No. You know, all these things were no. Okay. Everything pretty much was no. The only thing like they could say maybe you want to cut back on was foreign aid. Foreign aid is like $30 billion or less, okay, than the 1.7 plus trillion that is spent every year on the budget, okay? These people, where are the cuts? Where? You know, foreign aid, it's nothing. It's so fractional. So where do they want to cut? They don't. These people are whatever. I'm so conservative and I want to cut. And I wanted this and that. And I want to do so good for this country. It's not a revenue problem. It is a revenue problem. It is very much a revenue problem because we got so many loopholes to where they ain't paying the so-called 39 point whatever percent or 35%. They're not paying near that, okay? They showed, you know, Romney, he's paying way under 14%, okay? And all these other people. So where is the problem? It's revenue.
I got you, John. Charles wants to address that. Charles, could you speak directly into the mic? Because I'm speaking directly. Eric tells me that I'm louder than everybody else, so kind of.
Yeah, following up on your point, and again, the Bill Maher piece was really interesting. It was a whole just a sequence of asking people, where do you want to cut, and they all said no. Am I okay? To your point, the thing about cutting – and it goes back to the thing that happened with Rob Portman and his reversal on the gay marriage issue. And he, I don't know if for those of you that might not know, he found out his son was gay about 2 years ago, and so he's changed his position, and he's the only Republican senator to come out for it. There was a great cartoon that I saw today that said, Rob Portman reverses his position on entitlements because he was hungry. And then they had a cartoon about showing how he hadn't had breakfast, and he felt this weird sensation in his stomach, and oh my God, it's hunger. And so I'm not against entitlements anymore. The point is, it's always the backyard. How do you determine, how do you talk to people and say, make it your issue, make it something you know, make it the guy down the street or your parents or your son that's gay or people that you know that have been thrown out of work, put a face on it and put a face on the stories, even the most hard-hearted, far-right folks, if you get the right connection and you get a personal connection to them where they have a personal example, and the example of, I thought that cartoon was great, hey, he's hungry, so I'm going to stop entitlements. Anyway, but that's my point, is I think that's the approach we could take and should take. We're talking to these people. Don't look at the talking points. Relate it personally.
You know, that was in the Political Brain by what's his name? Drew Weston. And actually, I saw Drew Weston at a conference. I think it was a Netroots conference that I saw Drew, and he's a great speaker. 518 wants to say something. 518, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Egberto, Joe Pomponio, over in New York. How are you?
Joe Pomponio, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I have a question for Charles when he brought up the part about building from the bottom. Let's hypothetically say you have 20 million people that need jobs. Half of them are over 50, okay? You have businesses looking to leverage buyout public services, okay, and not create any jobs. Just consolidate everything and send the jobs overseas whenever they can. How do you build from the bottom? Minimum wage is nice, but if you want to raise a family in this day and age, these 20-year-olds better start making $25,000 to $35,000 a year, or they're not going to have any hope. So, Charles, could you try and explain to me what building from the bottom is?
Okay. The age thing is just a starting point to what I'm talking about here. We're trying to figure out how to gap. This is a very explicable way to start moving that line at the bottom. That's number one. To your point, I'm over 50, by the way. And what I have been finding, which is very fascinating, I'm a techie, and techies are considered to have their brain fried after 30, okay? I've seen that so many times, and I'm so tired of it. But I work at the university, and one of the universities here, I won't say right now, but anyway, major university, and I have gotten to the point where I'm a graybeard. The young techies come to me and say, you know, I don't know where you got that idea, but it actually makes sense. That's because I know history, and I have seen this situation 30 years ago, 20 years ago, whatever. So what I'm getting at here, and this is a larger picture, but try to tap the wisdom of the people that are older. Come on. Our brains are not frozen. And, oh, by the way, if you look at any of the major companies, Google, for example, TI I worked for, Texas Instruments, they rever older techs. They use the older techs. And they're the reason why, for example, I use TI as an example because I worked there for 10 years and I love the company. They have an older population that has stayed active, and their wisdom is paid attention to, and it translates to business advantage. That goes back to my other point earlier. If you try and see if you can put things in the cast things in financial terms in this case, or business advantage in this case, you can make a lot. You can change a lot of minds because they're all, if, for those people that only look at the bottom line. I can show you that having a team of 10 experienced people over 50 will blow the doors off of an army because they know how to do this stuff. Does that help any?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. By the way, I'm retired and 63, so I got a few years on. But man, my point would still be Okay, we have a vast number of people with lesser incomes or unemployed hires. My feeling would be bring them back, okay, into work with taxes at a livable wage, okay? Taxes they pay will go a great way to covering our financial problems. What we have, by and large, I'm going to use the term plutocratic society, that seems to be, well, if you don't have skin in the game, starve. If you don't have skin in the game, you don't get medical care. If you don't have skin in the game, I don't want you to talk to me about job projects with carpenters and plumbers and electricians and construction workers back at work building our infrastructure. I'll do it for less with unemployed paying minimum wage. You see where I'm coming from.
I certainly understand your point, and I agree with it. Let me go in a slightly different direction. Let's look at what we mean by cost of living. Part of cost of living is obviously eating, right? Having to buy groceries, having to get food, all that kind of stuff. Well, there's another group that I can highly recommend, and there are many around the country. The one I'll mention is called Transition, and if you look up Transition Houston as an example, or a place called Urban Harvest in Houston, we have built, I say we, I'm part of this organization, I'm very happy to be participating, we have built in the Third Ward of Houston, Texas, a community garden where we feed a couple hundred people from a garden that they grow their own stuff. They don't have to put their income out to buy things because they grow it in their community with their neighbors. That makes their spending dollars go a lot further. And by the way, it happens to also have the benefit of health, and it has the benefit of knowing your neighbors and working with your neighbors and working with families. This is another aspect of making your dollar go faster. There are tons and tons, and I'll make sure I feed it to Egberto, of things going on locally all over the world, not just in the cities.
Actually, Charles, I'm going to want – you can come in anytime you want, Mary. Charles, I'm going to want to actually not only talk to you about that, but probably if you can give me a tour sometime and we can do some videos and give that some publicity. I mean, I saw your shirt and saw the things that you did, but I didn't quite know that it was that intense. So thank you for making us aware of that, and that is something that we need to put out there because it's definitely not getting the coverage it should.
Well,
and 6-3, I'm coming to you next.
Let me just do a quick follow-on.
Yes, sir.
I've also got very good ties with Texas A&M University, which is, of course, agricultural. They
right.
have a student farm that's 50 acres, and they do feeding of people from that, and they take their output and give it into the cafeteria, so the students are actually raising their own food in the cafeteria. And, oh, by the way, that saves money on the cafeteria side because they don't have to buy food from other places, and they get it by carting a box across campus. So
right.
I'm saying let's think way
think
out of the box.
Outside of the box. I think you're so right. Mary, you wanted to say something?
Boston, there's one called the Food Project, foodproject.org. They have about an acre where they grow food in the inner city in a poor area of Boston. I think it's Roxbury or Dorchester. And then out in the suburbs in Lincoln, they have a farm that's, I don't know how, a lot of acres. I don't know how many.
Mm-hmm.
And they grow food out there, too. So that's a wonderful project they're doing there.
That is excellent.
Does this help address what he was asking? Can
Joe, was that helpful?
Well, indirectly, yes. It's just... I don't know how much food you can grow in downtown Manhattan or
right.
Chicago. You know, you get into major cities with large populations.
Go to 630, Joe.
Not to pay you more money.
Right. I think one of the issues that you wanted to was a more technical answer as far an answer as far as Joe Blow yesterday you want to increase the pay of 20 million people. Oh. Exactly how do you do that? I think that was more of your question. Was that correct?
Yes, because they pay taxes.
I'm going to let Kurt take a crack at that. And 6-3, I promise I'm coming to you next.
Yeah, this is something, in fact, I remember doing a series on something that I thought I'd invented a term called an inclusive economy. Actually, when I Googled it, I found somebody else was already
using it. You're kidding me.
And what the idea is that you need to make it possible, or basically an economy needs to be welcoming for people to engage and are educated. And you really have to start very young, is that we have to give children a hunger to participate, not just in games and that sort of thing. I'm not sure what it is the fare that we're getting in whatever. I know I'm a professional, and a couple of professional associations that I deal with are actively recruiting college kids to get interested in various forms of engineering. But I think that the trick is to get them at the very early age, get them in the inquiring minds into math and science and so on, and the possibility, regardless of where they're coming from, whatever situation they have, they need to believe that if there's something that they want to do, that there's probably a way they can get there.
Charlie wanted to add to that as well.
Well, I wanted to take another crack. I'm sorry I went a little off track there. Specifically to your question of the aging population and trying to figure out what they're going to do next and how they're going to try and make a sustainable living, check out a group called SCORES, SCORES, Society for Retired Executives. This is international, I believe. Point. It was actually started in Fort Worth, Texas. That's where and they have a very good presence in most major cities. These are people that are retired, that have been high-end executives, and they offer their time free to advise people on what they should be doing next. What kind of business, what kind of area, what kind of careers. This is free stuff. They give time back to the community. They're a wonderful organization. I highly recommend you look at it, and they have real solutions based on their experience in the higher end, you know, high executives or small companies or whatever. I highly suggest you check that organization out and look at the educational opportunities there.
That was actually excellent, because when I was forming Willie's Computer Software Company, I went to the University of Houston. They had a symposium over there, and I used them to learn quite a bit about business, because I had zero business experience. And those older guys, like you mentioned, they were invaluable in giving you ideas. So, I mean, those kind of structures really work. So I think in combination with what Kurt had to say, both from starting from young and how you bring folks into the workforce by giving them that type of that structure, and what you're saying is for those of us who are already grown and unemployed and wanting to do something new there. So, I mean, I think both those two centers are a combination of what Joe Pomponio was actually looking for.
Does that hit a little better, Joe?
Yes, it does. With these groups, I'm not looking for someone myself, but I'm becoming involved in a lot of community activities up here. And quite a number of people in that 50 to 65-year age group have been lost for a good 7 or 8 years. And, you know, again, it's good proof helpful. I'd have to look into it. I have to talk to the people. But are they geared to working with people that have a high school education, come from backgrounds in manufacturing, because plants have left, farming, which is turning into developments? You see where I'm coming from.
Yeah. Short answer to your question there. I don't know there are specific programs in that regard, but the fact is that this is just an incredible wealth of information. I can't believe they haven't had to address that particular issue. I'd highly recommend to get in touch with them and see what they say.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Let me take another whack, too. I'm going to do a little bit of a side shift here, but not long ago I heard Gavin Newsom being interviewed. He's former mayor of San Francisco, now the lieutenant governor of California. And I've always been skeptical about minimum wage, as some of my friends can tell me, can tell you. But he pointed out that San Francisco has the highest minimum wage in the country. It's like it's $11 plus. And the city of San Francisco has single-payer insurance health care for everyone, and a number of programs. So your friend is blinding us here. But the interesting thing is that the city of San Francisco has tremendous public services and a large minimum wage, and it all works. And that's which amazed me.
Sounds good to me.
Get away, Egberto.
We kind of muffled Kurt there because we're taking pictures of our group here in front of all these mics, and all the flashes started going off, so we took Kurt a little bit off subject. But anyway, it's okay. We are going to go to 630-630. I'm so sorry for holding you so long, but I wanted to complete Joe Pomponia's point. How are you doing today? Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Good, Egberto. It's Jeff McKinley.
Hey, Jeff. How you doing, buddy?
Good. How are you?
First, let me give you a proper introduction, Jeff, to the group
here.
Folks, Jeff McKinley is one of our very libertarian, I won't call you conservative. He's one of our very libertarian followers. He's a friend of mine. We go at it probably every other week or so. Talk to me, my man.
Okay, I just wanted to make a comment because I think it was possibly Kurt that had said that rather than going after CEO pay and upper earners pay to try to go to, you know, the lower end and raise the minimum wage. And first of all, I agree. I don't think you should go after the upper, you know, people. For instance, if you eliminated the CEO's pay of Walmart completely, you would be able to give everybody a one penny raise. If you eliminated the United Healthcare's salary, the CEO, you'd be able to give a discount on insurance policies of 4 cents. Just the magnitude there is just too great. So, one, I think it's futile. Two, I have other issues with it from just, interfering with the, you know, wage-setting processes of the marketplace. So, I agree, leave the upper-income people alone. But probably for different reasons, but we get to the same result.
You
now,
know
you
what?
Back,
before let me jump in there because I think from the time you've been calling this show, this is likely the first time that we are hitting such common ground, and it took my my very very liberal buddy Charles to agree with my very 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 libertarian buddy. That is just great. Make your second point, Jeff.
Well, the second point is trying to lift the people at the lower end of the wage scale up by having government-mandated minimum wages. Now, the statistics behind minimum wages are these. One, people over 25 years of age, only 2% of that working population earn minimum wage. Only 5.3% of minimum wage earners are from households below the poverty level. 40% of the minimum wage earners live in households with incomes of $60,000 or higher. And the last one here is that, you know, people like to set it up and say, oh, it's the single parent that's, you know, trying to make ends meet. Only 82% of the minimum wage earners do not have dependents. So what you're trying to accomplish there, I don't think you're doing it, and I think that this data set shows that. Further, you know, I know that there's some people saying that a higher minimum wage does not, you know, reduce employment, but it has to. You know, the laws of economics are that, you know, the demand curve for any product out there and workers are no different is downward sloping. If you have a higher price, you're going to have a lower you're going to have lower employment. It's just the law of economics.
I have an argument for that, but I think Kurt came up with it first.
Yeah, I hope so. Anyways, we were talking earlier in the session during the class that somehow it came up that back in 1945, the end of World War II, had tremendous national debt. Back in the 1920s, the highest marginal rate had gone down to 25%, tax rate had gone down to 25%. But when we came out of World War II with this tremendous debt, The highest rate, which in today's market would today's dollars would be probably if you're earning over $3 million, you'd be that increment you'd be paying 94% on, and that also started the great growth period that this country has ever experienced. And I think some of the factors were, one, with that kind of a tax policy, people would tend to leave money in the enterprise. They were also leaving more in the pockets of their workers. Their workers were then able to buy dishwashers, which were just being invented, cars, Levittown homes, whatever. And so if you have something to sell, you need to have a buyer. And right now, and we've gotten away with it recently, and it was also mentioned by somebody else during the meeting about easy credit as being a substitute for a living wage.
I actually stole that from economist Richard Wolff. Richard Wolff is the one who showed that what our system had done is it actually gave, instead of giving people wage increases, they gave credit increases. So which means they got more buying power, but how did they get it? By paying interest otherwise. So, I mean, it's amazing. Jeff, stay with me, but I want 404 in. 404, who do I have the honor of being with?
Hey, guys, Robert Rodrigo in Atlanta. How's everybody this afternoon?
Roberto Rodrigo, how are you doing, my man?
Good. I'm sorry to come in a little late. I'm actually working for a living out here. You guys are just hanging out on the phone. Ah.
Wait a minute. What do you mean you're are you saying that we are not working for a living? We're here working.
Yes, we are, aren't we? Absolutely. I'm just playing a little bit because I'm going on vacation this week.
Oh,
I'm
well,
just playing a little bit.
Hey, you know what? I think Jeff, by agreeing one time with us today, just earned that vacation. So why don't you pick up?
You know, listening to some of the comments, especially the last few of them, my opinion about both the data end of it and about the essentially the patterns of the past, both present unique problems in that, to me, they're incomplete with today's situation. And I'll give you an idea. From the standpoint of raising the minimum wage, number one, I totally think it has to happen because even at the $9 that they were discussing at the federal level, not even to get into San Francisco's rate or the one they're trying to do in Minnesota, for example, that only leaves a person who works a 40-hour week an $18,000 a year income. Now, putting aside data and putting aside whatever economic argument you want to make, can anybody on this phone call live on $18,000 a year? That's the point.
Not at all.
You know, it's not happening. So regardless of any other information, when they talk about raising the minimum wage to $9 an hour, nobody says, but that only equals $18,000 a year. They leave that aspect of it out, and so it's like a talking point, essentially, to me. But the other dynamic is when you talk about the economics and lowering, you know, and having a negative impact on employment, what's being missed in that argument is that we have slave, and you've heard me talk about this, we have jobs that have been outsourced in this country that we are never getting back. I don't care if you tariff. I don't care how many loopholes you close. The fact is that you may cut into the profits. You may make more money available, but you still cannot replace the fact that 50 people can work for what my highest paid employee would, if they were doing the outsourcing and construction. That's never going to change. They're still going to keep that because it still keeps their profits at a maximum. And it's happening, as we've discussed before, in major industries that are important to us. Technology, as you've talked about yourself, in your own experience, manufacturing. I mean, that stuff is going out the window. Customer service, all that stuff. I mean, if they can get 25, 30, 40, 50 people. And I gave an example of my niece is married to a gentleman who's in banking, and he's been flying over to the Philippines training people because they have 30 people working in his division that for one person that he had. So we're never getting those jobs back. The only way we would get any of those back is if they raised the wages in the world, and that would be nice to happen, but it's not happening. And then when you go back to – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, before you go into the other subject – I think Charles was going to do a little refuting on the $18,000. I want to hear what he has to say, actually. And then I bring you back in, Robert.
Sure.
And Kurt's going to make a follow-on comment on that. Let me refer to you. I'm a techie. There's a particular site that I recommend everybody to look at, and if you can, it's called Slashdot, and it's a news for nerds, stuff that matters is the name of the thing. And there was an article about a week ago, and I'll get you the reference point. It was an article written that said, here's a family of four living on $14,000. And they told how they did it. They did it by buying houses in a certain area. They did it by building their own stuff. They did it by growing their own food. They were able to. I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it is possible. That is a specific data point, and it's getting a lot of attention on Slashdot, and it's starting to get out on that. That's point number one. Point number two on manufacturing coming back, highly recommend you start looking at something, and this is something, again, I'm a techie, so I'm really into this stuff, but if you've heard about 3D printing, okay, this is being able to manufacture things in your own house with a $100 appliance. I'm talking about being able to make car parts and furniture and all kinds of stuff. Now, it's still very much in its nascency and very new, but this is also bringing back manufacturing in a local sense to the entire world. This is happening everywhere. This is happening in Houston. This is happening in small towns. I've even seen a small town of 50 people be able to have manufacturing of being able to make things locally using local materials. You can actually grow the plastics in your as a agricultural process and use that. The point is, this stuff is happening, and it's going to happen down at the personal level. And, yes, you can get paid for it because there are people that will buy the things that you make. Anyway, I'd like to recommend that you look at that entire area before we kiss off manufacturing.
Now, you know, let me just add a little to that. First of all, Charlie sent some very good emails out, so you may want to get on his list. He always has some interesting information to provide. Secondly, I agree with Charles on this new structure, but I tell you one thing. We have to change. Before Charles is a very smart guy, before the rest of America can get to that point, we have to teach them. So that is where a lot of groups like what we are doing, some of the things that we are going to have to do within our types of groups and showing people what this new economy is going to look like, or not show people what this new economy is going to look like, but we are the ones that are going to have to design what this new economy is going to look like. And I saw you come to the mic, Kurt. Could you come to it?
I drifted off a little bit before you gave it to Charlie. What was the?
Oh, I just thought that you had that you were going to respond to.
Oh no, that
okay. That well, let me bring back Robert into the discussion because Robert was quite interested in what he was talking about. The minute I was coming here, Robert.
Yeah, and mind you, from what and that's great information. Just from what Charlie was saying, I'm not kissing manufacturing goodbye. What I'm saying is that manufacturing is only going to continue with outsourcing going on, regardless of any other aspect that we're going on. The jobs that we have lost, that, you know, they talk about closing loopholes, bringing jobs back here, that's not going to change. There's always going to be manufacturing, of course, certainly. And I'm not talking about in the future, but as far as where we are today, I think we need to realize that that's not going to happen no matter how we attack the corporation. Those jobs are going to stay out there, and we have to find new ways, which is certainly what Charlie was talking about. You know, and actually, when you talk about alternative ways to make money, first thing that comes up, of course, is alternative energy. You know, and when you talk about the history, again, it's a different world when you're coming, like we were coming out of World War II with the other example, as far as what to do and what wages there should be and what tax structure there should be. Again, we have a different world. There's not a lot of new things going on out there. One of the aspects of when Clinton was president, when the economy was thriving, is, you know, even before that, you had the creation of the Internet, for example, that was just beginning to boom. We need to R&D, which is an aspect that we need to definitely support, needs to be pushed more because we're running out of things that are new to give the society a boom. And you've talked about that yourself, Roberto. It's in the way that we're kind of stagnated. I seem to recall last year when we were closer around the election this conversation.
Right, I was talking about stagnation. I was talking about stagnation. I think that's an important that's a very important concept. Actually, I was talking to it, and I don't know if you recall, in the concept of, if you remember in my book where I spoke about the patent system. The patent system is a hindrance to innovation. And because the example that I gave was that example of me not being able to innovate on a particular product because Amazon had a patent on it. There are farmers who would love to innovate with their own stuff, but who has pure seeds anymore? Now the seeds are owned. So there are a lot of these issues. There's always room for innovation. You know, you innovate whenever you're a builder, if I recall.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you innovate in the processes that you use to make a better home all the time. However, if somehow a rich builder decided to patent certain types of processes, then you would be just as would have the same problem that I had when I attempted to do a particular piece of software. And it's that corporate control of our economy, that corporate control of our government that actually create that type of a modal. And that is some of the things that we were talking about today as well, both things
right.
that Coffee Party is strong on and Move to Amend is strong on. Yeah, go ahead, Robert.
Right. Now, and the other aspect is as far as the wages are concerned, you have two things going on. You have below the poverty wages, and then you have entitlements. You have safety net features. Well, you know, from the aspect of, let's say, the more conservative approach where you have smaller government and you wanting to – one of the areas, of course, that are obviously a drain, regardless of what the percentage is, are the social safety nets. And then you go to the more progressive aspect of it, you know, and you're looking to either, well, you've got to leave them there because of the way the wages are or you have to raise the wages. Well, to me, it seems kind of – a paradox for the conservative approach not to support raising minimum wages because you, in essence, remove the need for the social safety net for so many more people because you've raised them above the poverty level where, number one, they wouldn't qualify, of course, and then, of course, naturally, they wouldn't need it. So it seems to me like, and I have no issue with smaller government. I want responsible government. You know, I am definitely more progressive if I was going to have a title. But I get the more responsible government. I want it there to do the things that it's very good at and that we need in society, important things. But certainly if we give people an opportunity to make more money and raise the wages, regardless of the equality of the wages, if we take them out of the poverty level, then we don't have the extensive need for the social safety nets, except for the real, you know, the people who are disabled or all the circumstances that really would be left other than just not being able to make a living wage.
Why I love to hear your calls is because as a builder, a business owner, somebody who in a general field where people try to depress wages, that you think that way is actually very important. And I hope other builders are actually listening to some of what you have to say because
I don't have anybody on minimum wage. My lowest paid worker across the board is $11 an hour. There's no one in my company that makes more than $10 an hour, makes less than $11 an hour.
Anybody listening, anybody listening live or anybody listening to the podcast, what Robert is doing is actually a patriotic deed. He's not listening to those writers that are, say, or the right-wingers that are trying to depress wages because they have to make more profit for that. But why responsible? The difference here, however, is I believe, like I said earlier when I gave my little talk here as well, we cannot force people to be benevolent, but we can legislate what needs to be done to keep a country appropriately. So did you want to say something, Kurt?
I think Robert also likes to have – he has some good workers and he wants them to come back.
Exactly. The thing about
Absolutely.
It is – we need more Roberts out there. This is excellent. Robert, B Corp, what is it called? B Corporation is the link. I mean, it's the thing that you need to look up on the internet, okay, that Charles just brought forth. Anyway, look, stay with me. Robert, I have 620 that I'm going to bring in, but I'll keep you hot because you're quiet right now. 620, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
This is Jack Golding.
Hey,
Jack Golding.
Jack Golden, how you doing, buddy?
Jack, okay, got many regulars. Suggestions. I think we need to keep in mind Fareed Zakaria's thesis that we need to they have a way of doing the infrastructure of our train.
I think that's the infrastructure bank. Is
maybe
that correct?
$200. What?
I think that was the infrastructure bank, right?
Infrastructure bank.
Yes.
That's the thing. You don't. In fact, you don't. It's going to be mainly financed out of private capital, not.
Yes.
With the possible cooperation of city, local bank, and maybe state.
Right.
Capital, very little federal government. The federal government,
I know where you're going, Jack. I know exactly where you're going. I think you had actually brought that up maybe a couple weeks ago because I think you had seen the Fareed Zakaria program. Is that correct?
Yeah, I listen to Fareed Zakaria regularly.
Right.
And another thing, I'm encouraged by the news that the Senate got a budget going.
Yes, sir. They sure did. They sure did get a budget going. It's not going to be going anywhere, but at least they got it done. Hey, Jack, hold on with me a while. I want to bring in 770. Who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hi, this is Patrick Thompson calling from Atlanta.
Hey, Patrick.
How you doing?
Excellent.
Talk to me, Patrick.
Hey, one thing, a lot of ideas floating around here, but I have several renewable energy companies that have started here in Atlanta. To me, that is the new industry that if we had the impetus from the government and the infrastructure build that we need, that could be the next great thing here in the U.S. We could knock out our operational costs that we spend so much money in renting energy and put that into more useful things. We could put a lot of people to work. You know, this is the type of work that has to be done here. You have to be physically touching it, like Roberto was saying earlier. These are jobs that you have to be here. You can't really do, you know, build somebody's roof in India or China. It has to be done here. I do think if work was done here, we'd start making more of our equipment here.
Let me ask you something, Patrick. Patrick, what kind of companies are
I'm sorry, you cut out there.
I'm sorry. What kind of companies are you working with?
My customers?
Yeah, you said that you're working with some renewable companies. What kind of companies are these?
Yes. So, no, that's a different question. So I have three renewable energy companies here, one that is about installation. It's actually the engineering side. One of my companies is around financing because that's always a question, how am I going to pay for this? And number three is around manufacturing. We're trying to make a panel that does some things that are very different. So three different initiatives, three different types of companies, but all involved in renewable energy, primarily solar.
That's pretty good. Now, your solar panels, where are they coming from?
You can't really find American panels. I don't know if you know that or not, but
I've heard that.
Yeah, we run everybody out of business, so you have to go somewhere else. So who's making panels? The people that are making panels are number one, Japanese and Koreans and Germans, people that have been involved in world wars because they didn't have energy and they had to go get it. And now they're realizing their borders are pretty finite and their resources are very finite, so they've been forced into making it. Number two, they're very good at doing it. You know, a Samsung or a Sanyo or, you know, some of these other companies, they've been manufacturing stuff for years. They're very good at manufacturing. And so those are some of the people that are involved in manufacturing.
You know, Patrick, we are not against. We want commerce, right? Not only would international trade. We just want fair international trade. So, I mean, I don't think we have to make excuses for using foreign products. I just think we need to be balanced in what we're doing to ensure that, you know, our people as well have the ability to make money just like any other, you know, any other folks in any other country. Come on in, Charles.
Let me say that you do want to make some things because, you know, when you lose the ability to manufacture, go back and look at the starting of this country. There were some very interesting treatises made or written about how we were just natural resources for Europe.
Right.
And we needed to manufacture our own stuff in order to be relevant. And I have a good friend at NCR. Everybody's familiar with NCR as a company.
I remember.
Manufacturing overseas. They recently came back and put their headquarters in Georgia. When I asked the CEO, you know, what was the impetus? Number one, he said, well, you know, there's also a market here. There's a market in the U.S. We need to be close to our market. And number two, we believe that the next great manufacturing thing will come from the U.S. We have people who know more about manufacturing here than any other developing country we've been to. So we think the next will be from the U.S.
And we sure don't want to lose that. Now, Charles wanted to get into the discussion.
I had a question to you. Green building is very big here in Houston. There's all kinds of stuff going on here. And one of the questions that came up in a panel that I saw talked about builders like yourself that want to push the renewables. And even though you can, it seems logical that you can go to somebody that has an existing structure even and say, hey, I can save, you know, 50% on your power bill, they still can't seem to get the picture. They don't sign up for the renewable stuff. What rationales or how do you convince people that already have stuff or even people that are building stuff to go renewable? I'd really like to hear what your rationale is.
Yep. Number one thing, especially for a homeowner, for companies, they get it. Companies are starting to do it because they know the economics. You know, a Walmart is doing it. Walmart's one of the top companies worldwide putting solar on. So
that tells you confirm that.
Yeah, that's somebody who understands the economics. So for a homeowner, the thing to realize is if you're going to be in your home for 25 years, what thing could you do for your home that, number one, would last 25 years, that would be warranted for 25 years, that will work for 25 years? Can you name one product in your home that will last 25 years?
Please tell me I don't.
No. So secondly,
only the structure itself.
Yeah,
so
So 25 years of making energy, and the closest thing I can relate to with people now is because is things like smartphones. And when you have a smartphone, you know, it's amazing. We went from one phone in the home to now everybody has to have a phone. And look at the costs. The costs are, if you really net it out, you're renting your phone every month.
Right.
We used to hate renting our phone, and now we're back to renting our phone again, and now we're renting four phones or five phones, depending on how many people you have in your family.
You know, earlier I was actually mentioning it's amazing how sometimes the way you frame things make a big difference, because I've never looked at it that way, and the way you framed it, I'm like, hell, this guy's right.
Yeah, well, you are renting your energy from the power company, and you're at their whim. If they say we want to build a power plant, you're going to start paying for it now. They may never build it, and that may not be something you want to build. But you work for them. You're paying a monthly, you know, stipend to these guys to build things. And so I get people to look at, what will you pay for energy over the next 25 years? Most people don't even know what they're paying now. So we sit down and look at their bills. We go through a month and we look at a year, and people go, oh, my God, I pay that much for a year? Yes. Now imagine that going 10% a year conservatively, and that's very conservative. It's going to get worse.
I think Charles want to answer some of the thing you just said.
Oh, my God. When they sit down and think about it, they think about the cost of solar being whatever it is, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, whatever for the house. But then when they look at the cost of energy over time, and it's $200,000, $300,000 for 25 years of energy or more, then it starts to, oh, my gosh, are you kidding me? That's my retirement. That's my college plan. That's my, I could do a lot with that money.
Before Charles comes in, I want to ask you a question, Patrick. A solar system for average-sized home is about $20,000, is what you're saying?
It really depends on what your state has for benefits. The feds have great benefits. It really depends on what the state is doing that gives you either grants or helps pay. Sometimes even your power company.
Right.
Cooperative will pay.
What is the average size unit that you put out there?
I recommend for everybody that they take a look at hot water. Hot water is so easy to put on. $10,000 to $15,000 you have, because that's one of your biggest energy hogs in the home, producing hot water for your kitchen, your laundry, bath, shower. That gets expensive. So this.
Hey Patrick, drop me a line with a link to your stuff. I'd really like to kind of examine that. Even though you're in Georgia, I know you can give me some advice. I think Charles wants to say something, and then Mary.
Mary, go ahead.
I'm coming at this from a little different thing, related though. I work with a company that has a really state-of-the-art water treatment system, and not only the quantity of water, but the quality of water is going to become a huge issue in the days to come, and we don't want to be relying on just buying bottled water. We have no guarantees. There's no government regulations that guarantee the kind of water you get in these bottles. It's a ridiculous amount of money. You could be getting water somebody just drew out of a tap. And then the bottles are a huge problem. They're all mostly going into landfills and not being recycled. But so what I want to see is, as new homes are being built, that they get a water treatment system. We've got a massive lot of construction going on around our area here north of Houston. Many, many subdivisions are being built, and there's a lot of office construction. And it would be wonderful to see this water treatment become the standard in the area, that it go into every house and office or as many as possible, because it would really be a solution to a big problem. And in a similar way to, you have an upfront cost with these solar systems, but over the years, they pay them, and of course, the water treatment system would do the same thing while giving you the best quality water you could possibly get. So
that's an excellent point.
Another thing we need to do.
Excellent point. Charles, you wanted to add? And then, John, I'm coming to you. I saw you cycle.
Okay, two points. One is to with your cost question. A friend of mine in Austin put in a solar on his house, and it was $15,000 after credits by the city of Austin. His cost was about $5,000.
The only problem is that it's Austin, and I don't think Houston has.
Look at city as well as state.
Yeah.
Look very specifically in your area. And by the way, Bryan, Texas, which is just north of College Station, is looking at doing that kind of thing too. So it's not Austin, number one.
You know, Charles, maybe we should actually start some sort of a project to get our mayor to start looking into stuff like this, because I didn't know that Austin had that kind of a credit. That could make a big difference here.
I don't know what they have now. That was a couple of years ago.
Right.
The fact is that we need to look at the state governments, the city governments as well, because they can actually have an effect on the cost directly, and they can be very significant. That's the first thing. Second thing I wanted to ask him was, are you working with the energy companies in Georgia? Because Reliant here in Texas is doing a lot of work with smart thermostats.
Oh, yeah.
They will give you and install them, and they will give you price breaks if you will allow them to control your thermostat while you're gone. And that's significant because they can control they get enough people being able to control the energy flows in residential things. That can make a tremendous difference in their bottom line and be able to handle brownouts and stuff like that. Are you working with any energy companies in Georgia?
Yes. Yeah, so back on.
That was for you, Patrick.
Yeah. So, number one, the energy companies here in the South, unfortunately, are not our friend. If you don't have something that burns something, they're not as – I'm a threat to them. Now, Reliant is a very good company. Reliant understands that the energy distribution, they're just buying itself. They've transformed the company. Well, that is not happening here in the South. They're still fighting the competition. instead of trying to solve problems. Austin is a great town. Austin is one of the leading areas of the country for solar, and one of the things that helped was putting a kicker to help people make that transition. And I get this all the time that, you know, we don't have grid parity with renewables, but dude, if you took, especially now, especially if you took out the oil and gas and coal companies get to help them do business, they've been how many years? They're we're all in the industry, and we can put a lot of people to work, and we don't get those same benefits.
You're kind of breaking up here, yeah. But I think we get the point. Let me go ahead and by the way, thanks for the comment. I need to bring in a new caller, then I'll come to you, John. 630, who do I have the honor of speaking with?
Hello, Roberto, it's Jeff McKinley. I hopped off and got back on.
You mean you actually hung up on us, Jeff?
I thought I lost my place in the queue. I had things to say.
Oh, man, you heard our feelings, man. Come on in and say what you got to say, my brother.
Well, it's just on a few topics here. One was that, correlating a high marginal tax rate to economic growth is really a falsehood, because what a more proper measure is the tax receipts in relationship to gross domestic product. And if you're talking about the late 40s, early 50s, in 1950, the rate of tax collections to gross domestic product was 14%. Most recently, it's been running around 18%, given the in the rates, the highest rate right now is 35%. So the rate that you're quoting really is irrelevant in the overall analysis.
I stop you right there, Jeff? I mean, first of all, you are absolutely correct for that statement you just made. The rates are irrelevant. What's relevant is what you're actually paying. Now, you made a good comparison when you said 14% versus 18%. There's why is that we are not making that same, or let's say, why is it that conservatives aren't making that same issue an issue when we discuss the actual corporate tax rates today? Because the actual corporate tax rate, the effective corporate tax today is lower than it's been in decades.
But, Alberto, if you want to talk corporate tax rates, there's another...
No, I'm saying, first of all, realize I'm agreeing with your overall statement. However, the reality of effective tax rates on corporations now, it's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, I think the effective tax rate on corporations now should be 0%. So, because it's primarily, studies have been done, and corporations physically pay the tax, but corporations do not feel the impact of the taxes. In fact, there was a study done by a trio of professors. One of them was out of Harvard that did a study on this. It's a very hard number to get your arms around, but they said between 40 and I think it was 70% of any tax increase is borne by the employees of the company. Then you've got the customers of the company. Then you have the people who are actually the owners. So it's really inaccurate if you're trying to extract the money out of the owners of the corporation. It doesn't work, and you tend to, start harming the employees.
Okay, Jeff, I have one thing, a statement that I want to add. Okay, and like Bruce wants to get into the discussion. So, Bruce, grab the mic. But I have one question for you, for you, Jeff, and it goes this way. Earlier, I made the statement to the group here that the average appreciation of the wealthy, let's say the top 1%, runs at between 7 to 8%, okay, on their capital appreciation on a yearly basis. The average growth of the economy over the last few years, let's say 2-point-something%. That means that the argument that the pie is growing, so we shouldn't really worry about those with higher capital, it's an arithmetic impossibility. How would you argue that particular point?
Well, that is your measure. Is it overall wealth or is it income? Well, income, I guess, would penetrate.
And that's the aberration. That is the one thing that upsets me with people when they discuss income, because they want income from all kinds of sources, income, but when it comes to capital gain, somehow that's a special kind of income. I think that's a fraud. But, I mean,
Well,
you
there,
know,
are,
but,
there are some reasons because
I know that I've heard
I've heard
all the reasons. But before Jeff, let me get Bruce in because I think Bruce hasn't spoken for a while and he really got riled up. So I want him to say peace. Go ahead, Bruce. Talk into the mic, please.
Back in 1954, the tax rate on corporations, corporate income taxes, was 6%. It's now less than 1.5%, and if you're saying that all the customers are paying for all the taxes, then why don't we do away with all income taxes and other taxes and let the corporations just pay taxes for everybody?
You know what? Believe it or not, if you want to make an argument, that is a darn good argument.
Well, I guess so what that could be is that could be, you know, something that's been floated just in a different level of who pays it, physically pays it to the government. But basically what you have there is just a consumption tax.
Yeah, but what he just did is he just increased efficiency by a whole bunch. So not only did he put the onus of paying the taxes on one entity, but he increased efficiency amazingly large by doing that. So, I mean, you know, we can define that. We can find out the those people that are really fighting for the tax structure of corporations, whether they would actually want to bargain like that. I bet they won't take it.
Well, I think that could be a very valid point. It's just make it a consumption tax, and then you're taxing consumption as opposed to, you know, taxing productivity and business startups and you know, various economic activity. You're allowing the economic activity to not have that burden on them. And
Look, Jeff, I'm going to have to stop having you call this line because if you agree with something one more time, you know, I mean, I'm going to bring John in for a second here because I'm going crazy with you saying, oh, maybe that has some plausibility. You see, Jeff, why I say we talk, my man. Hold on a second.
There's a great intersection here between, you know, libertarian thought and, you know, those on the left.
You got
thought.
That
There's
right.
A great intersection.
You got that right. Let me bring John from Jersey because John from Jersey hasn't been in a while. Hey, Jersey.
Yeah, I have something later that I wanted to mention, but I'm going to mention this quickly because you guys are talking about it, which is funny. Now, okay, well, what about, like, people who are buying stocks? And, of course, most of the people who buy stocks are wealthy. Like, how come they're not paying, you know, for taxation for all the stocks that they're buying?
Tax. You don't want a tax on that.
You don't
that.
Want it. Well,
that,
why?
No. Because, well, here it is. Because the current bill that DeFazio and Harkin have introduced to their respective chambers of legislation, at the rate that they want to tax them, it would eliminate 100% of the financial transactions in many futures markets in the United States, completely eliminate them. Because what they would do then is, you know, it's a mouse click. It's all electronic. They would go somewhere else. So that would completely eliminate it. It would, there's a lot of trading going on, arbitrage trading and so forth, which leads to the efficiencies of markets, and that will greatly curtail that. So
well, we're in a computerized system, and you're just lobbying. I mean, basically, that's how I see it. But
no. Lobbying, please refute my facts. Okay, I'm stating facts. I'm not lobbying. Thank you,
Jeff. Let me get. I think Barnes Bruce has some input because Bruce really does the numbers as well.
Well, you're talking about the consumption tax, and with the consumption tax, it's a sales tax of 30%, and it would tax everything that is tangible, your car, your house, or whatever. It's not tax intangible things that wealthy people have and trade or transaction on, but it does tax everything that poor people sell or buy or anything like that.
Okay, you want to comment on that, Jeff?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the, you know, if the alternative system is a consumption tax. I don't know if the, you know, alternative system is a flat tax. You know, a flat tax with, you know, a minimum threshold. There's various ways of looking at this. I think we've got to get tax simplification. I think that it's just muddied the waters too much, and it's had too much effect on our economic activity. And which one of those, you know, would warrant a lot of study?
Okay.
Egberto.
Hold on. Let Bruce come in, and then I come to you, Robert.
Go ahead, Bruce.
A flat tax will increase the taxes on the poor people and will decrease the taxes on the wealthy people, because that's the definition of it. It lowers it down to a flat tax. The other thing is, a flat tax on what? Is it going to be sales tax or income or wealth or anything else?
Okay, folks, so let me tell you, we are at, yes, exactly. You'd have to put a sales tax on all that. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Here's the deal, guys. We're out of time, so it's time for a closing argument. So I'm going to ask everybody to be brief this time around, because it's a lot of folks. So I'm going to start with Senor Pomponio. Joe, please come on. And just give a quick 15, 20 seconds, sir, please.
Okay, Egberto, it was a great show. A lot of nice discourse. We got a lot covered. And I'm really interested in Prometheus. I'd like to get something like that going up here. Good show.
Great, that would be great. You are just the kind of guy to do it. Not only that, you have that great radio voice. I mean, I know you're going to be good. Come on, Rodrigo, come on in.
I wanted to let you know that actually my building is commercial, and I can let everybody know that the commercial industry is definitely, from the private standpoint as well, is definitely booming, and everybody knows in business what that means, and that means that all other aspects of society are going to start building infrastructure and residential homes. Pay attention to it, because now that we're out of the first couple of months of the year, I'm all over the place. I'm working in the United States, and I'm certainly not a big construction guy, so I want to pay attention to it, guys. Walmart's in the mini mart business. They're opening up gas stations. That'll tell you something.
Thank you, Robert. That's your closer. Okay, let's go to Senor Charles.
The main closer I'd like to give is thank you, Alberto, for this show, and thank you for all the people that called in, because to me, this is an example of, and I'm going to save this recording, this is an example of we can find intersections. We had a tremendous amount of agreement on a lot of stuff, and that doesn't happen very often. And I really thank Berto and all the people that are here and called in, because this is what we need to do. We need to work together, not call each other names, not throw around talking points, but get to agreement and then go and do something. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charles. Kurt?
I really don't have a whole lot to add. It's really been fun. This is a whole new twist. I've never done this before, but it's been great. And yeah, it's been great to be able to trade ideas and to see what other, see where we do have intersection.
Thank you very much, Kurt. Bruce?
Thank you. I really enjoyed today and everything. Thank you, Roberta. I hope we continue on this, especially on the taxing points and the wealth, the inequality in this country. So let's talk about that later.
Thank you, Bruce. And look, I really enjoyed, and thanks for all those numbers that all of you guys come up with. That is what it's all about. The using crowd. Mary?
Yes, this was a very good show. It was a good follow-on to the discussion we were having earlier on, which was the wealth gap, the income inequality. And we kind of covered a lot of subjects, but they're all related to that, because I believe that that is the biggest problem that we have in this country now. There's more and more information about it coming out all the time, but yet still there are many, many people that do not understand what it is, or if they do, they have no idea how many orders of magnitude it is greater in this country than other countries. So this has been a good discussion.
Thank you, Mary. You were great. Jack Golden, come on in.
Okay.
Closer, Jack.
Yeah. Capital gain should be taxed as ordinary income.
Okay, I like that. That's a quick closer. Now let me go to Jeff. Jeff, I made sure to go to you after him because he said that.
Okay, am I up here, Egberto?
You are on, Jeff.
Okay, thank you. It was great to, there's a lot of common intersections. One thing I want to say is just have your minds open to libertarians out there. The Pauls are libertarians. There's other libertarians. And just one more word. I called into the show, and when the topic was inequality, I really wanted to talk about this on a different level. And what I think we need to do is we need to take the big box of inequality down from, the shelf and open it up to see really what's in there and dig all the way to the bottom of this. And, to toss out a couple big words here, I think that if we examine this on the deontological level, which is a historical level of income and wealth, versus the teleological end source, that's really the brass tacks of what this argument is. And I wish I would have been able to expand more on that, because I think we've got to really open this box, see what everything is in there, so we understand what our premises are as we move forward.
Jeff, you know we're going to cover this subject over and over again, and as usual, you know, we always want to hear your point of view. And as far as libertarianism, I do go by some of the principles that I do follow. Some of them I just think doesn't fit me. But that said, we all live in the same country. Thank you for calling, buddy.
Thank you.
John, you're the last one today, buddy. That's for calling first.
Okay. Yeah, the one thing I wanted to say quickly is a great show. But additionally, one thing that you guys brought out is the price of oil, because it affects, like you guys can talk about the thing about and it was sort of neglected by some of the people there, but the thing of raising wages and jobs and all this and that. But let's never forget, like, the automotive thing went overseas, right? But when the price of oil goes up, it costs more money to bring cars over in containerization. So jobs did come back because of the price of oil. We can never forget that.
Thank you very much for your closing statement, John. And thank you, everybody, for calling. This has been Politics Done Right. I'm McVerta Willis, your host. Thank you for spending 2 hours with me today. Please remember that, folks, go to www.coffeepartyusa.com. www.coffeepartyusa.com. Please join our 535 project. Remember, we're putting somebody in every single district in this country and assigned to every single senator. We are going to make a difference. It's going to be slow. So don't expect miracles in a year or two, but we're starting the process to create a movement. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful Saturday. Thank you, guys. This was